Hugh Hefner is the crowned head of the Playboy empire, a fantasy land he created in 1953 with the first issue of the now famous Playboy magazine. In the little more than 20 years since the Playboy bunny became an artifact of American culture, he's parlayed his magazine into a far-flung enterprise that now includes two magazines, more than 15 nightclubs, a series of resort hotels, books, records, occasional motion picture productions, and several theaters. And with it all has come a steady assault on the Puritan ethic, a series of disquisitions called the Playboy philosophy. Catering to the sexual fantasies of Americans, urban male has made Hugh Hefner a millionaire, providing him with the means to live his own fantasies. Girls galore, a bunny-equipped private jet, and a home with all the accoutrements of a satyr's daydream. Hugh, I've often wondered whether a middle-aged man can find happiness with millions of dollars, all the creature comforts the money can buy, and what seems to be an inexhaustible supply of dazzling female playmates.
It's possible.
It is possible.
It is possible. It's another interesting, I think, about our society that we are very suspicious of those very things that are supposed to bring happiness, and that conflict exists. I've had it both ways because I came from rather humble middle-class origins, and
you weren't particularly happy there. Rich is better.
Rich is better. Yeah.
Well, I've read about
and even better, of course, if you're more importantly, if you're doing it, you know, on your own terms, in terms of something that you believe in. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's the real pleasure.
I've read about you that at least in the recent past, you never had time to enjoy all these things because if you threw over the Puritan ethic, you certainly didn't throw over the Puritan work ethic.
I think that's true, and was particularly true at one point in my life, much less true today. The boy is father to the man, and so I still fight some of those same Puritan things in myself that I'm fighting in society.
Do you find yourself at all uneasy fighting those things?
No. I'm just, you know, aware of it. I'm a very introspective person, and but I would say that one of the things, and I'm really grateful for two things, both the success, and because it is for me a very personal, it's really not a business, a very personal success, but also the fact that I'm lucky enough to be put together in a way in which I, psychologically, where I'm able to enjoy it, and I do.
So you've licked the being a slave to your own...
Yes, well, I don't, you know, the battle's never over, is it? I don't mm-hmm. think it's ever won. It's a lifetime kind of adventure.
Well, you did work for 72 hours straight at times, did you?
Yes, 72, maybe an exaggeration, but I used mm-hmm. to go around the clock. Mm-hmm. But it was even then, it was kind of a burning candle at both ends sort of thing. See, most of the reports about me are for a variety of reasons, are kind of misleading and half-truths.
Intentionally?
In most cases, I think not. I think it has to do with hang-ups in our society. I think Playboy and the guy who runs Playboy are difficult to write about. Again, probably because of those Puritan ethics. I think the two big hang-ups in our society are money and sex. And when you put them together, it's particularly difficult. Mm-hmm. I think there's a kind of almost a Rorschach test sort of quality about writing about Playboy in which you get... you know, two-thirds Playboy and one-third preconceived ideas, prejudices, you know, pro or con. Mm-hmm. And so that what comes out in the press is often not so much about me as it is about society.
What is happiness to you? How would you define it for your own personal purposes?
Well, personal fulfillment, I think. First and foremost, doing what you really want to do. And, you know, hopefully being successful at it. Mm-hmm. The real pleasure for me, you know, I've been rich and poor, and rich is better, but the money, the nice thing about money is not to have to think about it. Money was important to me when I was poor. It's nice to be able to relegate it to a kind of a secondary position. It gives you the freedom then to you know, to do the things you really want to do and that are more important.
You've created, I suppose, a kind of image of the modern American male. Do you feel any compulsion to live that image yourself? Because, as you say, they write about you, they write about what you represent. Do you feel that you have to live that life? You wouldn't get you're perfectly happy doing it, I gather.
Yes, I would say that that's the degree to which I do it. In other words, obviously, I am a public figure and wouldn't be if I hadn't wanted that. In other words, I'm not in show business. There aren't very many editor publishers of magazines that are well known, so that didn't happen by accident. Mm-hmm. But there's a pleasure in that. But
a pleasure in what? In being well known?
Yes, there is. Yeah.
In adulation?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Man doesn't work for bread alone. Mm-hmm. It also cuts a lot of corners. I mean, you can do things that you couldn't otherwise do. You don't have to wait in line to see a movie or to get on an airplane.
That's good.
They're convenient. There are a lot of things we do. You know, one of the things you try to buy, whether it's with money or fame or whatever, is time. I mean, time is one of the most precious things of all. We only have X number of years on Earth, and a lot of it's wasted. So, in a lot of things that I do, I try to improve that and you know, get the most out of it.
Do you feel pressed for time? Do you feel it's passing very rapidly for you?
Yes.
Does it pass at a greater rate with each passing year?
Yes, there was a period in my life, as a matter of fact, when I was so unhappy about the fact that I had to spend 8 hours of every 24 sleeping, that I investigated seriously the various, Russia was working on a sleep program that, some machinery that was supposed to eliminate about half of the, because the body doesn't really need much of the time that we spend sleeping if you can go into a deep sleep quickly, but I never worked it out. But I am very conscious of the fact that, you know, time is passing, and if you're really enjoying life, you want it to go on a little longer.
Are you conscious of other people, a concern for other people? I ask that because what you've just said sounds as though your own happiness obviously comes first, and is that all?
No, it's a long ways from all. Mm-hmm. I think other people on both a personal level and society-wide, planet-wide, really, I'm very much concerned and rather deeply committed.
You're not worried about the ones who have to wait in line where you don't have to wait in line?
I don't think that's the most serious problem that our planet faces.
No, I think... It's sort of in a metaphorical sense, I hope.
seeing that we have a planet about 100 years from now is, I think, the first most important consideration, and that people are able to live on it a little more decently than they are today. But I would say at the heart of my life, I accept the fact that I am very self-oriented, and coming to grips with that, I think, is a healthy thing. I think almost everyone is, and should be, as long as it's rational and humanistic, you know, not just a day-by-day kind of exploitation thing.
You say that you've been poor and you've been rich, and rich is better. Did you grow up in relative poverty?
No, I wouldn't call it poverty.
Not really. You grew up in Chicago, of course.
Yes, Chicago was home. My folks were farm people, came from Nebraska. My father, they're both still living. My father is an accountant. But I was raised during the Depression, and we never wanted for anything, but we were not wealthy, you know, middle class.
Mm-hmm. And it was a family in which you have said that you were never really free until you invented your magazine, so it was not exactly a free life in the sense in which you enjoy a free life now.
No, but I think that a lot of that had to do with the traditions that were, you know, accepted at that
time. It's not unusual.
My folks are both college educated and were school teachers for a time. Came from a strong Methodist, rather almost fundamentalist Methodist background. And a lot of that idealism stuck, but a lot of the trappings didn't. It was the trappings and the very traditionalist morality related to sex and pleasure.
Were you in any sense a rebel against those
yes,
as a youngster?
Yes. Yes. I think that's, as a matter of fact, I think you look to the roots of that as the explanation for Playboy, although it wasn't conscious at the time. Mm-hmm. I can see
now.
All I can see now that, you know, I was fighting the same kind of things on the playground when I was a kid that that I do in the magazine now. Mm-hmm. In other words, the kind of social inequalities and things that that bother me then have simply gone on and grown and disturbed me now.
You were described as a rather shy, introverted adolescent. Doesn't sound like a rebel who was fighting on the playground.
Well, I don't know whether being introverted has much to do with idealism, etc. There was a period in which I withdrew, and that's when I was quite young. We're talking about grade school now. And that's important. And what I withdrew into was a lot of my own dreams and fantasies, and that's what led me to writing. Because I think that anyone who is interested in the creative arts, to some extent, needs that sort of detachment and that kind of introspection. So it's that I was referring to. And, you know, that led me into all kinds of, you know, writing and cartooning. And
you were a cartoonist.
Yes,
I'm surprised to discover.
I produced my first, directed and produced my first movie when I was 16 years old.
Where was that, in high school, I suppose?
That was, one summer in high school, did a horror film called Return from the Dead. Hmm.
You also did a
mini classic.
Also did a cartoon strip when you were in high school, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, it's a great many of them. And one in particular that was an autobiographical comic strip about my friends and myself, which I, you know, continued for many years, and then that turned into kind of a scrapbook of, you know, autobiographical nature about what we've been doing.
Did your friends enjoy and accept this, or were
yes.
they a little offended?
No, they didn't. I think I did it as much for them as for myself. Yeah.
What about girls when you were young? One always has to ask that of the publisher of Playboy. I mean, in high school, isn't
that adolescent? Yes, rather typical, I think. Shy when I was very young. I used to be very interested in animals when I was a kid, and then I discovered girls and kind of lost interest in the animals. And now I've just...
But with all the hang-ups that come from the...
Rather typical ones. Yeah. You know, the usual difficulties in dating, but, you know, that was... eighth grade and beginning of high school, and I went steady a couple times in high school, and really moved, I think, into a more extroverted, outgoing personality in the last 2 years of high school. The usual kind of adolescent adjustment, in many ways typical of my time. I think my folks were rather typical of their generation, really believed the Horatio Alger sort of American fundamentalist values, and I responded to it in a way I think that is rather typical of my own generation. And that and the insights that it produced, I think, are responsible for where I've taken my own life and for Playboy.
After high school, you went into drafted into the Army and spent some time in the Army, then came out and went through the University of Illinois with a degree in psychology. Mm-hmm. Were you heading in a particular direction at that point? Was the writing still uppermost in your mind?
Yes. They had a special school at Illinois for war veterans that permitted a greater variety in terms of the courses that you took. And so instead of going into journalism school and getting involved in what I felt was going to be a lot of dry detail, I took a variety of courses and majored in psychology, minored in creative writing and art, specifically because I was interested in magazine work. And I felt that understanding people. And,
you had no thought of starting your own magazine at this point, though, did you?
In a kind of far-off way, I did, yes. I've been starting magazines and publications since I was in grade school. My first newspaper, a little penny neighborhood paper, was started when I was 8 years old.
And a compulsive publisher.
Yes, I guess so. Something of the... even in looking back, as a matter of fact, at the stories that I wrote when I was in grade school, they have the publisher stamp about them, because in addition to writing them, I bound them and illustrated them, and there was the editor at work even then.
You didn't start your first real successful magazine, Playboy, until after you had left another magazine, Esquire. Mm-hmm. You'd worked on a number of jobs and then left Esquire suddenly. Mm-hmm.
I worked in their promotion department for 1 year, and that was about a year and a half before I began Playboy, and they moved the last of their offices to New York, and I decided to stay in Chicago. And
you didn't want to move?
I really, at that point, wanted to start my own magazine.
Did you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that they wouldn't give you a $5 raise was...
was a good excuse for not
just
going.
Just an excuse.
Yes. But if they'd given it, I would have gone.
Now, when you first began, when the magazine first began to take shape, what were your objectives, other than to have your own magazine, to have control of it, to do what you wanted to do?
Well, that was the top of the list.
It was.
Yeah.
To be your own man.
That's right. And to, you know, and to put together a book that you really believed in. I found, as a matter of fact, I found real personal fulfillment, corny as it sounds, for the first time then. And that's part of, I think, what led to the compulsive work thing. I was so turned on by...
But you had to start this magazine with borrowed money, without too much money, as a matter of fact. You couldn't have found fulfillment at the very outset, could you?
Yes, because the first major problem was, would the magazine be around a year later so I could continue doing what I was doing? Mm-hmm. I felt as successful, relatively, in the first 6 months as I feel today. Because, of course,
why?
I had no idea what was
now,
coming.
Why did you feel it? What was the secret of its success? Why did it catch on so quickly from your
That I did not imagine before the fact. It was a matter of being in the right place at the right time, you know, with a point of view whose time had come. And
this was the
what I didn't know was that there were a great many other guys out there who you know, had these same views, and they weren't being expressed anyplace else.
Mm-hmm.
So that... from the very beginning, from the first few truly amateurish issues, because in the beginning we were really just learning what we were doing, I had never worked professionally in an editorial capacity for any other publication when I started the magazine. So I had to learn what I was doing while I did it. And we had no money at all, literally no money, so the first few issues were really, you know, almost a local kind of publication in quality. And the initial reaction was phenomenal. People saw the spirit of the book and what we were trying to do and responded to that even before the quality was there.
The spirit, not the Marilyn Monroe calendar picture? Or
I don't think, you see...
the voyeurism that was a part of the book?
No, because there already existed at that time. It's forgotten now, but there were other girl books around that had nudes in them at the time. It was the combination. It's so often, that's one of the things that people tend to overlook. Life did a major piece on us some time ago in which they talked about, the title of the piece was The House That Sex Built. Sex is only a part of it, and that's the part that still isn't clearly understood. The whole idea behind Playboy was to try to put sex back into the total fabric of the interests of man, because traditionally in our society, we've kept them separate. We've created a whole concept of the devil in the flesh in competition with the spirit of man, body pitted against mind and spirit, this earth and its pleasures pitted against the hereafter. It was that fundamentally that I was really fighting. And it's something that even today is not clearly understood. I mean, we'll still take raps in the press about, you know, on the one hand, the magazine has excellent editorial content, but then it also has a rather voyeuristic attitude towards sex. Well, that's the whole point of the publication, that human beings are and should be, at best, healthiest, total in accepting the animal part of their humanism, and that this really is a humanistic thing, that when you try to eliminate the sexual aspects, and I don't mean sexual exploitation, I mean the normal, healthy interests in
you don't regard this as sexual exploitation?
No, I think exploitation is a much misused word. Mm. There's a marvelous phrase in Naked Ape, you know, voyeurism is a healthy, non-participatory activity. Mm. The world should look at the world. And I think that we suffer from, still today, serious, even at the same time that we have a lot of obvious sexual exploitation, I think we still suffer from serious sexual repression. And I think that's the thing that the sickness and harm comes from.
Have you any fear that Puritanism will return? There are some indications
that
maybe...
Yes, there is some indication of it. I mean, unfortunately, there's a little portion of it in the women's lib movement that's gotten, you know, that part of it, because it is so publicizable, and has gotten a lot of the attention, you know, the sexist thing. I think that sex, more than religion or more than any other single consideration, is the major civilizing force on our planet. If there weren't two sexes, there wouldn't be family units, there wouldn't be, have been tribes and cities. And if we are in many ways still in the 20th century superstitious savages that don't seem to be able to come to grips with living on this planet in a healthy way, if there weren't sex, it would be much, much worse. Now, that doesn't mean that sex is not misused and isn't exploited, but it does mean that sex at its best is one of the most humanizing forces on the planet. And that we are a society that has found sex to be the single thing that that we consider to be the real obscenity is a very sad commentary on our world.
I would have thought that was love rather than sex.
What, the real
civilizing influence?
Well, where does that kind of love come from? I don't think, in other words, pair bonding, etc., comes from the attraction of two people of the opposite sex. I think love is just the cultural trappings, isn't it?
It may be.
I think so. It's because sex at its best, even today, is you know, sort of a dirty word. As a matter of fact, there's that conflict that you talk about between sex and art, or pornography and art. If a picture is not too sexy and it's well done, then it's art. But if it, even our definitions of obscenity, if it appeals to purient interest, then it's obscene. Well, what is purient interest? We use it as if it means simply sexual arousal. What is this thing about sexual arousal that we are so ashamed of? It's one of the most attractive things in life. It makes, for a great many people, a rather tedious existence more pleasurable.
Such things as art and philosophy are oftentimes inconsistent with business. You're in a multi-million dollar business now. You're in competition with others, mm-hmm. many of whom are imitators of you, mm-hmm. but who've perhaps carried some aspects of what you're talking about to even further lengths, and therefore, perhaps, are a threat to you in a business sense. Does this concern you at all?
Not in any serious way. I think the competition is a rather healthy thing. That's an easy answer, but I think it's true. And I'm happy that the competition, since I knew that we enjoyed a period of some almost 20 years without any competition, which is almost without parallel for a successful magazine. And at the same time, on a worldwide basis, the magazine was the most imitated. The fact that the competition now comes from imitators rather than from some new insight or concept that has caught the fancy of people, I think is a very good thing. It's both a tribute to me personally and also much easier to deal with.
Doesn't this, with the exploitation of this particular thing, doesn't it push it closer to the time when it too will be pushed into the past as simply a period in our publishing history, let us say? It seems that when you reach a point of excess, that's the beginning of the end.
I think you have short-term cycles that follow that, and at the same time, you know, the more long-lasting cycles. I think you see the excesses that existed in the 20s, leading to and partly responsible for what happened in the 30s, which was kind of the hangover after the party. But that is still a rather short-term phenomenon. I think that on a longer-term basis, we are becoming more, I hope we are, more rational about, and more liberal, and more about not only sex, but all of the various social problems. See, I think there's a close correlation. Mm-hmm. I think that sexual repression goes hand in hand with all kinds of other social repression, racism and the rest of it, and there are very real evidence of this. I think that a repressive authoritarian society is also the most Puritan.
You sit at the top of a very large business enterprise, mm-hmm. which seems constantly to be expanding into other fields. Mm-hmm. How much is enough? You once had essentially a one-man enterprise. You control most of it. You certainly can't control most of it now.
bigness is quite unimportant to me. In other words, on the one hand, obviously you enjoy it as simply a kind of an indication of the success. And if you're interested in communication, and that's one of the things that motivates a person when they are in publishing, communicating with more people has its own satisfaction. But I dislike, on a personal level, the fact that I am more removed from the day-by-day things that I really enjoy, which is editing, as a result of the success.
You wouldn't like to pull out entirely and enjoy your gains so far?
To some extent, I, as a matter of fact, have been doing that in about the last year. Not pulling out entirely by any means, but doing something that I felt was quite necessary for the good of the company because of its growth and also for me, which is something that I found very difficult in the early years, and it's called delegating authority.
Yes. You can do that now.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Doing it rather well now.
Hugh, much of your philosophy, of course, centers upon youth, the joys of youth, mm-hmm. pleasures of youth. How do you feel about growing older? You're reaching that midpoint now. How are you going to grow old gracefully? Can you forget that?
I think it's quite possible to do if you have the right attitude. I think that Otto Preminger made the observation once in a conversation that we had that you never really know how old you are because you never know when you're going to die. So at any given age, you never really know how far along in your lifetime you really are. It's a worthwhile insight. Another way of saying the same thing is really that, you know, the old cliche, you are as old as you feel. I think that one of the sad things in life is that people tend to grow as human beings when they're young in their school days, and during that period, life is an adventure. And then they settle down into what's called maturity, and often isn't, they just then begin to repeat decade by decade the life that they've already accepted. I think life should be that kind of adventure till you die.
You don't see yourself as the Esky, the old man from the magazine you left, as the aged playboy.
I think that you can go on making life an adventure forever if you work it right. Well, not forever, but for as many years as you've got.
Thank you.
Thank you.